Welcome back to MERS Monday. For more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. This week, Jamie Swofford, the running mate for Republican gubernatorial candidate Ryan Kelly, shares her background while also answering several questions from the America First questionnaire being circulated by activist Deborah L. Also, 10th Congressional District candidate Carl Marlinga speaks about his race in Macomb County, and the MERS team talks about the disappearance of the single-issue voter and the rise of a voting population that's more politically aware but arguably less educated. Now, here's MERS News editor Kyle Malin.
Thank you, Mark Bayshore. I want to start off this podcast today, Andrew, with a simple question, and one that you answered this past week in MERS after talking with several political experts on this question. Whatever happened to the single-issue voter? What can you tell us?
Only way to really answer that question is identity politics. So what happened was that one person who voted for that one issue that we all fondly remember, they got sucked into a point at which the party identity consumed that one issue. So they ended up aligning all of their other issues along with the party to make it their party. So that one issue may be their biggest issue, but all of the other issues they agree with the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, and it's just become a identity politics.
So, for example, guns or abortion. If you are pro-gun, if you are anti-abortion, then your default then is just to support the Republicans. Is that what you're saying? Because we don't have that many pro-gun Democrats. We don't have many pro-life Democrats anymore.
Exactly. That is exactly it. I mean, it's the one issue, that one issue that has traditionally been the single issue voter issue has just turned them into a Democrat or a Republican because and they seem to align more of their other issues on those extraneous issues.
So is this part of like the polarization? I mean, in talking with the folks that you talked to for this story, is this contributing more to the polarization of our electorate where you're either on one side or you're on the other side and there's really nothing in between?
Some of the professors that I talked to actually said this is more a symptom of the polarization, not causing the polarization, if you understand that the polarization. So there's a concept on social media known as the echo chamber. What the echo chamber is you sit in this bubble and what you say and what you think and what you believe is just reflected back at you. So if you have this echo chamber and you're sitting in this echo chamber, everything that you say isn't challenged. So if somebody else from somewhere else, say a Republican or a Democrat, come across each other, then their ideas are completely foreign and people don't like to have their ideas that are core and deeply entrenched challenged. So it causes that friction.
And we can go anywhere now, Samantha. We can go anywhere to get our information, whether it's correct information or incorrect information. There is a bevy of places you can go, whether it's on social media or it's on some of these new websites that report themselves or represent themselves as news. You can go to these places now to reinforce your own beliefs and further polarize yourself and even more entrench yourself in these beliefs that you have because you're not exposed to anything else.
Well, I think, and I'm going to pivot a bit away from that, Kyle. What I noticed most about Andy's piece is that it talks, that it suggests a conversation about adaptability and how can a party adapt and how can a voter adapt so that their issues are aligning with the candidate or the voters that they are going to come to a attachment merging to on an election day. I think right now we see on the Democrat side is that they have an opportunity to really ramp up their campaigns around conversations on gun violence and gun reform, especially in the state of Michigan, where gun violence is hitting home in ways that we haven't seen before. For example, the Oxford High School shooting in November of last year, that still is so fresh in people's minds. Another fresh topic, abortion, Roe v. Wade was just overturned. And even though I know that I had talked about this on the last episode of the podcast, you know, abortion is going to be on the ballot through the Reproductive Freedom for All Act that submitted a record-breaking number of signatures, but Democrats have a opportunity to say that if you want us to have competitive reproductive health access in the state of Michigan, you need to vote blue. And that's kind of created a very highly ignited battle cry on the Dem side. Meanwhile, let's look over at the Republicans. When we saw the heat of the MAGA brigade after November 2020, I think you saw election security, election integrity become a top issue for them. I think now you're kind of seeing that switch over where we're talking less about election and less about elections and less about affidavit to vote options and less about ballots. And now you're seeing more conversations on the economy and inflation. And, you know, Democrats kind of drew a short straw when it came to inflation and where we are right now. In June, it hit 9.1% nationally. So Republicans have this chance to really step up and say, we are, as always, the party of callous hands, as they could say. And, you know, we are the economic savvy, low taxes, business individual party. So I think, I guess I wonder if when we talk about single issue voters, well, you know, how are we adapting to the new slate of issues that have entered Michigan and our conversation here for both Democrats and Republicans?
I wanted to ask you, Andrew, about the single issue voters who were the union Democrats, the people who always voted Democrat because that's what the unions told them to do. And now we're seeing with Trump, these people moving on the Republican side. So how does this kind of shift with what the experts you talked to had to say?
So what that had to do with was more, again, it fell within the identity politics of the individual. So more of these working class folks, they feel that, you know, the issues that they deal with are, you know, guns and, you know, the freedom and how they feel about different things, rather than what the union is saying. Oh, you know, these guys are going to help the unions, and where the unions aren't as strong as they were back in the 70s and 80s, they've been kind of broken down. So it has allowed for those individuals within that to pick up an identity, a political identity, or and use identity politics to shape what they feel, rather than, you know, rely on the union. And to juxtapose that, I remember, you know, my grandparents back in the day were, you know, exceedingly Catholic, and they would get this slate of electors, of politicians to vote for from, you know, the Catholic Conference or from, you know, the Catholic church would send out these slates. And it's pretty much the same thing that the unions would do. Another thing too is that there was an interesting quote from one of the professors I talked to who said, the most informed vote, or the least informed voter now knows more than the most informed voter of the 70s.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that. I mean, that's kind of mind-blowing to think about, but we have become more sophisticated, haven't we? As just the general population, we're more engaged in this stuff than maybe we were back then.
Yeah, and I think a lot of that has to do with social media. People are more engaged with each other. They're more engaged with, you know, with everything else. And I think that does go, you had said earlier about you can go wherever you want to get the information that meets your ideals, what you want to believe. You can now tailor all of your information to be that. And I think rather than talking with each other, I think that is the point that has exacerbated this polarization that we've seen.
I think we have a revamped focus on state politics, one that, I mean, I would be willing to make the argument that we've never seen before. We look at the COVID-19 pandemic. I think that brought more people into the political conversation and becoming more engaged, rather how they felt about the lockdowns. Moving forward, we look at the Dobbs decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. People saw this immediate snap to states having authority over the topic of abortion. And I think a lot of people weren't expecting to see that immediate throwback. And, you know, I think now people know that, you know, whatever your views are, there is a lot of authority right now in the state hands. So who are your lawmakers? Who is your go-to gubernatorial pick? Who's representing you at that state level? I mean, I know that when I had initially pursued a position here at MERS, you know, I did talk about, you know, just really seeing firsthand the gap of knowledge when it came to people participating in state politics. You know, they could tell me who the name of the president was, or, you know, a congress member that has attracted a lot of social media clout. But if you were to ask them, like, oh, who is your state representative, they couldn't really answer that. And I think now you're seeing people really participate in the state level conversation. They are talking about who their local lawmakers are. They are talking about Senator Rosemary Baer, who is the senator of, you know, Oxford Township that experienced the high school shooting. They're talking about Senator McMorrow, who was called out in that fundraising mailer, and talking about, you know, what it means to be a suburban mom called out for the sexualization of children. They are talking about, you know, they're talking about, you know, state lawmakers have entered a conversation that we've never seen them enter before. And that does have to deal with social media. And I think it has to deal with how we pay attention to things because of what we experienced in 2020.
So, Samantha, you were in charge of the podcast last week. Thank you very much for the fine job you did on that. And I tried to dial out while I was in Alaska, but as much as I tried, there was one story that really struck me, that I just wanted to address here, that's kind of tied into this conversation. 76% of Michiganders don't get their political information from the news. That was the story from last Friday, July 8th. And this was polling that was done by the Glenn Gariff Group and Richard Zuba, who said that his data found that 63% of people get their news via the word of mouth, 13% at work, and 76% of people do not use the media as their main source of information for political events. Maybe I shouldn't have been surprised by that, but I think I was really kind of troubled, might be the best word here, that where folks are getting their news from is not from traditional TV networks, NBC, CBS, ABC, even Fox News. Only 10% of folks go to Fox News. 8% go to CNN and MSNBC. So where do they go, Andrew? They go to places like the Gateway Pundit and Breitbart, which are, what's the best way to call this? I mean, this is just people who are taking bits and pieces of information and framing a narrative. It's narrative building sites. This isn't news. This is just taking something to maybe advance an argument or a belief or something. I mean, this isn't news.
No, they're called partisan aggregates. So mostly what they do is they aggregate, they pull in news, or not even news, just they pull in opinions, they pull in pieces of information off of the web, off of the internet, off of places that you'll traditionally see some of your conspiracy theories spring up from, such as, you know, 4chan or Reddit, or, you know, not your traditional social media like Twitter or, you know, Facebook, but much, much more, much deeper. And they'll pull this up, and they'll pull these opinions out, and then they'll dust it off and claim it as their own. And a lot of the times they'll pass it up the chain, because places like Fox or places like MSNBC, because there are, you know, like Mother Jones is on the left,
right?
Or, you know, there are left leaning sites that do the exact same thing, and all of your mainstream media, you know, ends up pulling from some of this well sometimes. So you get, this is where you get things ending up on Fox that come from, you know, out of Gateway Pundit, or, you know, I mean, it's fascinating to watch some of these pieces of information filter through social media, and then filter through, you know, some of the other, they're not even, they're just aggregate sites. They're not, I don't even like to call them news sites.
Well, and then it just kind of feeds into the public's just general, while it feeds into their interest, they are more interested in politics, like we were talking about earlier with a single issue voter. I don't know if they're more educated. I would argue that they're probably less educated, because if this is the kind of stuff that you're reading from and you take it as news, how can you claim that you're educated on issues when you have a site that the second paragraph here that just flat out says rhinos such as Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky, former Michigan Governor John Engler, and never Trump DeVos family? I mean, is this news? I mean, just because it's free and it's on the internet, it does not make this news, Andrew. The headline being Never Trump Michigan Establishment Cheating for Tudor Dixon.
Well, I think, so I know some of my old mentors have been trying to educate the populace on media literacy, because these places aren't news. They're not journalists. These are it's right in the name. They're pundits, you know, but if you go out and ask somebody, hey, what is, you know, your normal average individual is, I remember back in the early 2000s, there was a poll done that more people thought that The Daily Show on Comedy Central was a news program,
yep,
than thought that the rest of the, you know, and it wasn't. Jon Stewart even said, who, you know, just this past weekend got, you know, the Mark Twain Award. He even said, I'm not a journalist. This isn't news. You know, we're a comedy show.
I mean, we have a completely different structure of how we absorb media and how we absorb news and how we absorb entertainment than we ever have before. People have the opportunity right now to pick and choose how they are digesting the current conversation. And people are picking these, you know, leading narrative platforms, you know, these arteries that serve a specific base, that serve a specific audience, and are telling these readers what they want to hear. But, you know, they have the opportunity to do so. You know, you think about, we talk a little bit about TV and broadcast news. Well, there's not really as many people that have cable news right now. As you know, people have their own streaming platforms. People are listening to podcasts. They get to choose what podcast they want to listen to, rather it be a news-focused podcast or one that has a political lean. You know, and even if you are reading a publication that is a traditional publication that does do objective reporting, there still is a column section, you know? So, I mean, it's not, I mean, I think to, I mean, is it definitely overwhelming to see people, as opposed to trusting an objective reporter, choose an outlet that is very open with the base that it is serving and the language that it uses and does write from an angle? I mean, it definitely is overwhelming, but at the same time, because of how media is laid out, people have the option to do so.
And they can digest their news from places that are not accountable to anybody at all. I mean, things like the Gateway Pundit is something that just has a bunch of these freebie ads on it. They don't have a subscriber base. It's free. Anybody can sit there and look at it. And if something is just a flat-out assertion here that it's incorrect, like Steve Mitchell being an employee or somehow a consultant with Tudor Dixon, which is not true, they can just go ahead and say it. And once it's out there, they are not accountable to anybody afterwards to correct the facts at all. They have no interest in doing so. They have no readership. They have no, there's no anything for them to have to go back and correct information later. It's just extremely troubling.
What is social media? It is people who, there isn't someone that they're being held accountable to. They don't, have an employer or someone connected to them or, an audience or an ethical code, because obviously journalists, I mean, we have that ethical code of being objective. But social media, I have a story to tell. I went to Central Michigan University, fire up. I remember homecoming. There is a popular bar in Mount Pleasant. It's called The Bird. And there was a wickedly long line. So a girl tweets out, "Everybody, Tim Allen is at the Blackstone," so that everybody leaves the line and goes to the Blackstone so that she could just get right into The Bird.
Did it work?
Yes, it did. People were like, "Tim Allen's here." He was not in Mount Pleasant for that homecoming. But, it's like I said, like people can just put something out there, rather they are putting it out there strategically, rather they are putting it out there just to put it out there, to express how they feel, to utilize social media as their political diary. It's just kind of a part of this new age digitalized world that we are living in right now.
I guess we don't have to like it, but I guess we are going to acknowledge it here as we move on to the next section of our podcast. Thank you, Samantha Schreiber and Andrew Miniger. Joining us now for the podcast is the running mate for gubernatorial candidate Ryan Kelly. She is Jamie Swofford. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
All right, well, let's get started here with an introduction. A lot of our listeners are not familiar with you. Why don't you explain a little bit about yourself and a little bit about your background?
Well, first and foremost, I'm a Christian. I was born in Kalamazoo, and I moved to Mattawan. I graduated in 2003, and at a young age, mainly in middle school, I decided I want to go into law enforcement. I've always been one of those types of people who are just, have to have it, has to be fair to everyone and all of that. So in middle school, I started researching basically the classes I would have to take for college to get my law enforcement degree. And in high school, I started dual enrolling. Because I didn't really want to have to pay for a lot of loans. And I know there's a lot of people out there who have a lot of school loans, and I did not want that to happen to me. So I took as many general courses as I could in school. They paid for a lot of it. And then from there, I enrolled into Thomas Valley Community College, and I got my associate's degree. Now, the reason why I went to Thomas Valley Community College instead of 4 years, because I would have ended up with a lot more loans in a four-year. So I definitely was so grateful to go to community college. So I got my associate's degree in criminal justice, and I also worked while going there to also pay for the loans that I would eventually get. So from there, I went to the police. I did a police internship in Kalamazoo Public Safety. I loved it. Everybody there was really great. And from there, I did some research, and I found out that Ferris State offered not only a bachelor's degree, but the police academy with it. And that was something that I really wanted, is just to have a school that offered bachelor's degree in a police academy instead of separately, because then you would have to pay more, again, more school loans. So I went to Ferris. When I got out, at the time, there was not many jobs at all. So then I went back to KVC, Kalamazoo Valley Community College, and I worked to get a fitness and nutrition degree. I didn't get the degree because I actually got a job at Kalamazoo County Sheriff's Department. And that's where I met and married my husband. I usually tell everyone we met in jail. So everybody usually starts laughing at that. So, I mean, it's true. We met and got married. And then from there, he had a sheriff's campaign. And that's when I really got involved in politics. From there, I kind of helped him out. I became his campaign manager. I started speaking at his events, doing fundraisers for him. And I got really excited about it because I kind of realized that our local offices are so important to us because they affect our everyday life. And a lot of people focus on like the country and the federal, but it's really the local that affects us, all the county commissioners, city council, all those people. And so I started getting more and more involved in the party, the Republican Party. And from there, he didn't make the sheriff, he didn't become the sheriff, but from there I grew more into the party and I started helping out more candidates, getting candidates that needed help. So I would help them out. I would, you know, give them tips, help them with their fundraisers, and all that was fun to me.
My understanding was that first sheriff's race, he ran as a Democrat, didn't he? And then he became a Republican later.
Yes.
Yeah, so talk about that. How did that come about?
I will say that he is a Republican, but at the same time, well, I am a Republican.
Okay. So you may have had an influence on him?
He really, what he wanted to do was he wanted to basically run as a Democrat so that he could get into the primary and be able to win. Mm-hmm. That didn't happen, and he lost. So he decided to run again as a Republican because they actually were helping us a lot more when he was in the primary for 2016. So in 2020, we decided to run in the Republican primary. And at the time, we didn't know that there was a running mate for the Republicans. But apparently, there was somebody else who was running. But, you know, we said, okay, well, it's fair. You want to run as a Republican, we're running as a Republican, that's fine. But as long as you guys are helping both of us, I'm good with that. So we ran he ran as a Republican. And then also, while he was running as a Republican, I started getting, like I said, more involved in the races. And we actually started branching out to the state. So we would go to events in different areas of our state. And one of the events we went to was actually an event in Atlanta, Georgia. Hmm. It was called Black Voices for Trump. And what we did there is we actually saw a lot of black conservatives. I had not seen too many, but we had saw so many of them there. And I was excited because, you know, we were able to connect with a lot of people. And they actually helped us throughout the campaign season of 2020. And in 2020, I actually coordinated an event called the Minority Summit. Hmm. And what that was is it's just educating minorities about religious liberties, the realities of socialism, and the U.S. Constitution. And from there, the former ethnic vice chair of the Michigan Republican Party noticed who I was. And he was actually leaving for a White House appointment. And he needed somebody to fill the position. And he asked if I was interested. And I was like, well, wait a second. What is it? What does it involve? And he said, basically, everything you're doing in the county, helping out candidates and you know, going to events, you'd be doing it around the state. So I was excited about it. So I ran it as ethnic vice chair of the Michigan Republican Party, and I got elected. So then from there, I kind of just like the next day I went to a fundraiser, and then from there just kind of took off. I went to all over the state, connecting with a lot of people, getting to know a lot of people, helping out candidates, advocating for them, speaking at events. And then during the 2020, after the election, the coronavirus hit. You know, everybody was kind of discouraged about it, what was going on in Michigan. So then I started doubling up my efforts to encourage and bring hope around the state. So I spoke at rallies. I hosted several events at my house for gubernatorial candidates, senators, congressmen, because I really believe that helping out these candidates would then help out the state. So I started doing a lot of that. And from there, I would connect candidates that I knew from different areas of the state to people that would help them in their campaign. During that time around the state of Michigan, I got to know Ryan Kelly. He was everywhere, just like I was. at, you know, rallies and speaking engagements. I saw him a lot. So I was able to talk to him a whole lot, too, which was nice. And as time progressed, we talked about some of our values and beliefs that we both wanted to impart to future generations. And then our mutual passion for America First, Michigan First candidates, you know, getting them elected. So because of that, we kind of got together, and then you guys know the end. He asked if I would be his lieutenant governor.
When did those conversations start?
We met 2021 at a friend's party that he had. At the time, I didn't know he was running as a governor candidate, and I was doing a presentation there. And afterwards, he did his presentation as a gubernatorial candidate, and that's when I started talking to him.
So what made you want to take a dip into this Republican primary race for governor as Kelly's lieutenant governor pick, especially while a lot of party insiders are still remaining, at least to the public, hands-off until August 2nd? So, you know, why now? Why so soon?
What do you mean by that?
Just essentially as, you know, why commit to this lieutenant governor position right now, as opposed to waiting until after August 2nd and to give this commitment to Kelly's campaign?
Well, Ryan Kelly believes in transparency, and I didn't think it was fair to, after you pick your governor, then people would see who was the lieutenant governor. And he wanted to be transparent about it. He wanted people to know, this is who I want to surround myself with. That's the reason why we did that. I think it's important because a lot of times our leaders don't do that. They don't have transparency.
So what was it about Ryan Kelly? What was it about what he was sharing that drew you to him, that you said, this is the person that I want to support and this is the person I want to see be our next governor?
A lot of it was his 100-day plan. The pandemic is over. I mean, everybody wants it to be over. In the first day, he said he wanted the pandemic to be over. That resonated definitely to me because I wanted to be over too. A lot of his, have you guys read any of Ryan's literature, policies, or anything?
Oh,
have you
sure.
heard of the first 100-day plan?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, so all of that, I was loving it, all of it. The budget audit, you know, incentivizing small businesses, reducing taxes, and, you know, growing our economy. And I loved everything that he was speaking about. So that's the reason why I wanted to help him, because he was really for the people. A lot of these policies that he's created and he's still creating, he goes around the country asking, or the state asking people, what do you want in your government? And that's how it should be. That's how it should be.
Now, I had heard that you were in Washington, D.C. on January 6th with Ryan Kelly. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I was in Washington, D.C., but I was not with Ryan Kelly.
Okay.
I was at a rally.
Okay. And so what did you see at the Capitol on January 6th?
Well, I was actually at the rally that they had with the speakers. So I saw a lot of the speakers, and I was standing in the crowd. That's what I was doing. But I got kind of, it was really, really cold that day. And when I was speaking and I was listening to the speakers, I actually left back to my hotel room to get warm because Trump wasn't going to be speaking for another 2 hours or so. So when I left back to the hotel, I took a nap and I woke up. And when I woke up, I realized it was too late to go back to the rally to hear him speak. So I turned on the TV and luckily he was just about to speak. So okay. I wasn't able to see him in person, but I did see him on the TV.
Did you end up going to the Capitol then in the afternoon when things got rowdy?
No, after he spoke, I met up with a couple of friends and we went out to eat. That's what we did.
So you weren't at the actual Capitol when things went down?
No.
Quite often when a lieutenant governor is elected, they wind up having a specific focal point that they work on, an issue that they work on. If Ryan did succeed and you were sworn in as lieutenant governor, what would that issue be for you? Have you talked about that with him yet?
My issue I would try to focus on a lot is veterans and law enforcement, because my little brother, actually, he's a military veteran. He was in the Marines for 4 years and he got out. And for me, law enforcement too, because I'm in law enforcement and I know some of their challenges that they have to face, and I want to help them.
Right now, we're seeing Republican candidates compete for a Trump endorsement. Are you concerned at all for how if the former president were to endorse someone like Tudor Dixon, it could disenfranchise some of the president's loyal grassroots followers who've already aligned themselves with the likes of Ryan Kelly or Garrett Saldano? So, and what are your kind of concerns if, you know, Trump doesn't go with endorsing Ryan Kelly, but makes a worthwhile endorsement that will have an impact on August 2nd?
I'm not concerned at all about that. Ryan has a very solid platform that is, like I said, for the people, you know.
So if Ryan Kelly does not win in August, will you support the GOP candidate who does win? And who on the slate are Republican gubernatorial candidates, would you not be able to get behind?
Well, none of them, because, like I said, I hosted a lot of events, and I've had almost all of the governor candidates at our house. I mean, I've gotten to know a lot of them, and I like all of them.
Now, are you familiar with Deborah L. over in Saginaw?
Yes.
All right. So she has an America First kind of questionnaire that she's sent out, and numerous people have filled it out who are running for office. And she has some questions on here that I'd actually like to hear your answers to. One of them is, what do you feel happened on Election Day 2020?
Well, I believe that wholeheartedly that I believe that Donald Trump won the election for president in 2020. And here are some of the reasons why. Rally attendance. Trump had thousands and thousands of people at his rallies, and Biden struggled just to get 10 or 12 people to his rallies. And then lack of campaigning on Biden's part. I mean, where was he? When you're doing campaigning, when you're doing any sort of political position, you have to campaign. And then the last one, which I just don't believe Biden won more votes than Obama. Obama was loved by many people. So I do feel that Donald Trump won the election.
What do you feel happened on January 6th, 2021 at the U.S. Capitol?
I don't really know. I wasn't really there. So, I mean, I could tell you what happened at the rally because I was there.
Right.
But they're investigating that. So I have no idea until that investigation is completed. I won't know anything.
And then one other question. In 2016, Republicans owned the whole government. How did we lose it all in 4 years and get a liberal Democrat with a socialist agenda in the White House in 2020?
I don't know. I wish I knew, because once I knew, then we'd be winning all the time. But yeah, I don't know.
All right. Should Dominion voting machines be removed? That's part of Ryan Kelly's. Yeah, okay. All right. And then do you support a full forensic audit investigation of the 2020 election?
Yes.
And do you believe there was fraud in the 2020 election?
Yes.
And again, for our listeners' benefit, this is a questionnaire that Deborah L. has sent around for Michigan Republican candidate evaluations as part of an America First type questionnaire that numerous legislative candidates have already filled out. Jamie Swafford, she is the running mate for Ryan Kelly on the Republican ticket. Appreciate you having some time and talking with us here on the MERS Monday podcast.
Well, I just want to say thank you for your time. I really appreciate it. So thanks so much.
Join us now on the podcast is a candidate in the 10th Congressional District. He is a former judge. He is Carl Marlinga. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Really happy to be here. Thank you.
Why don't you tell our listeners how you got to this point? You were a judge over in probate from Combe County. Folks know you from the prosecutor's office and have run before. What led you to want to run for Congress in the year 2022?
I really didn't see it coming until pretty late.
Naturally, as most people in politics, I always had the dream about serving in Congress. It's kind of like the ultimate. I had already figured out that my career was now at an end and that I would be looking at retirement. When the events of January 6th of 2021 happened, I was dismayed, shocked, disgusted, nauseated at the thought that after 200 and some years, the peaceful transition of power had actually been at an end, that now the Trump forces and Donald Trump himself were urging violence, ultimately to try to stop the election from being certified, meaning that they were actively trying to overthrow the government of the United States. And I was shocked. But then as the months wore on, it got worse, because then I realized that it wasn't just Donald Trump kind of talking to a angry mob of rioters. There was a plan at the White House to try to steal the election by not certifying electoral votes, by having the vice president not count certain votes, contrary to the Constitution, contrary to the 12th Amendment to the Constitution. The vice president's role is a ceremonial role. It's arithmetic. It's math. You open up the envelopes from the various states, and you announce what the vote is. There is no power that the framers of the Constitution thought that the vice president would have other than to open up the envelopes and say what the count is. And yet the Trump forces tried to use these unconstitutional, irregular means to try to stop an election, decertify an election, stop the right person from being elected. And when this congressional district opened up, I realized that, look, and I might be only one of 435, but I think it's the obligation of every American to step up and try to help the Republic in its time of maximum peril. And I think this is it, that if Donald Trump and his forces could do what they did with only a couple of months planning in January of 2021, I shudder what we might be looking at in January of 2025. Therefore, I want to be one of the members of the House of Representatives, along with a lot of other good thinking people, to look at the election. If it does get thrown into the House of Representatives, we'll do our constitutional duty and vote to elect President of the United States. But I want to make sure that it doesn't fall into the House's decision by some unconstitutional, improper means. And that's obviously, I spent a lot of time asking this, because this is the basic motivation why I'm doing this. I mean, there are a lot of other important issues, the choice issue, obviously, saving the environment, cutting down on inflation, making sure that we bring the manufacturing jobs back to the United States. All of those are important. However, saving the Republic, I think, has got to be the obligation of every American.
There's a lot of your constituents, though, Judge, who believe that the election was stolen, that Donald Trump won, and it was only because of widespread fraud that he had it stripped away from him. What do you tell your constituents or the people there in Macomb County who come back at you with that claim?
Well, first of all, there were over 50 court cases in which that line of attack did not prevail. And there was ultimately no evidence to back up those allegations. And that was decided in court. And this is the important part from a constitutional point of view. That debate as to whether or not an election was stolen, I'll even allow for the fact that if you think that it's happening, you bring things into court and you bring evidence into court. And if you prevail, then please, let's make sure that the right person won the election. The election should not be stolen by either the right or the left. We have to have clean elections. We have to count all of the votes, but we have to make sure that the votes are legitimate votes, and that nobody who's not entitled to vote has cast a vote. But once you have those court cases, however they are decided, and this is the constitutional importance, the framers of the Constitution said that the states are in charge of appointing electors. once the states appoint electors, the electors will cast their votes. It'll go to Congress. And at that point, it's just ceremonial. So if there would be a battle for whether or not there was fraud in Michigan, it begins and ends with the courts in Michigan. If there's a battle about whether or not there's fraud in Florida, it begins and ends with the courts in Florida. The framers of the Constitution wanted the states to be in charge of sending electors to Congress. It did not want a Congress, and it didn't matter which party or which faction, it did not want Congress to be there to mess up the electoral vote.
Before anyone in this race can go up against the likes of, you know, the John James machine, you have to win in a 5-person Democratic primary. This primary also includes, you know, a lot of women of color. I know that that's kind of a concern among Democrats about wanting to make sure you have that representation, especially with current U.S. Rep. Brenda Lawrence retiring at the end of this year. My question for you is, like, you know, why do you think that you're the strongest candidate to win in this Democratic primary.
By the way, you mentioned the woman of color. Rhonda Powell is her name. I know that you're not supposed to talk about your primary opponent's names, but I have high regard for Rhonda Powell, who would make a great person, as would the others, Henry Yanez, Hueda Araf, Angela Rogan Sees. These are good people, good Democrats. My argument right from the beginning is that, okay, let's put ourselves forward. I believe that because of my longstanding name recognition and the respect that I have, that I would be the strongest candidate to take on James in the fall. Each of us have a path to win the primary. Each of us would have a path to victory against John James. And that's why you have primaries. If the voters select me, I will be proud to carry the banner. If they select somebody else, I'm going to be working just as hard for that person. I told a lot of people at these joint rallies and debates that we've had that I'm going to be working until the last hour of the last on November 8th to work for the Democratic candidate. If that's me, I'm going to be working for me. If it's one of the others, I'm going to be working just as hard for them, because democracy is on the line. The future of the republic is on the line. We cannot allow the election of a person who has pledged his support to Donald Trump. John James didn't have to seek Donald Trump's support. He didn't have to accept the endorsement, but he did. And that's why if there's some foul play that's going on in trying to get the House of Representatives to not recognize an election, I would rather have a Democrat rather than a person pledged to Donald Trump. Now, all of these are fine candidates, and the polling shows that I'm the strongest. I have a 4-point lead against John James right now, 44% to 40, with 16% undecided. There were two other polls which showed me up by 3%. No other Democratic candidate polls that well. Now, can somebody else catch up? Of course. But why go with somebody where you have to build before you can start the battle? Go with somebody where the name recognition is already such that he has a 4% lead, namely me. This, in my mind, is the best opportunity for the Democratic Party. Go with that candidate. Right now, the polls show that it's me.
Carl, as you're taking a look and going around the district, what are folks telling you is the top issues that they want addressed? What are you sensing from the public?
Well, certainly the choice issue is prominent, because nobody saw that. I mean, we all feared that it would come, but when the Republican justices who were confirmed all made their pledge that Roe versus Wade was established law, they were conservatives. Conservatives are supposed to respect the value of precedent. They really lied. They did. And so we got stuck with the decision that nobody saw coming. It's a tragedy for the country. And certainly the choice issue is something that people are talking about, rightly so. The other issue, though, is it always is the economy. That the gas prices are out of control. People are worried about inflation. Inflation is the cruelest tax, because you have no control over it. It eats into your savings. People on fixed incomes, elderly people, are hit worse by inflation than any other thing. That obviously is a key issue as well. And there is one more. It's something that people bring up. In fact, a lot of Republicans bring it up. They say, Carl, look, we know that you're a Democrat, but we also know that you live here. You've been a judge. We trust you. John James does not live in the district. He said he would move in if he won. We don't think that's a good enough commitment to the people of this district. And so I've had Republican precinct delegates tell me that in spite of the political differences, they would prefer to have somebody who actually lives in the county. And we have polling showing that 26% of the people polled thought that was an issue that would be as significant as any other issue, namely the residency of Mr. James.
Now, I do know that there are, you know, portions of Oakland County in this district, but, you know, I think about Macomb County and the sort of red wave it experienced in the November 2020 election. Then I went to cover the Macomb County GOP convention where, you know, the whole building was beyond max capacity, people wanting to get involved and really fired up about having Republican candidates. What makes you feel confident that Macomb County is ready to backtrack that red wave that was experienced in November of 2020?
Well, there is a phenomenon in Michigan and politics in general that sometimes the noise of the crowd does not reflect the depth of the support. I remember when Michael Dukakis, who was badly lost the election, when he ran, the crowds that he gathered at the end were tremendous. There was a lot of enthusiasm. And so you can take a sliver of political thought, have somebody who represents that, and you get out of 900,000 people in the county. It only takes a very, very small percent to get thousands of people packing a hall. It doesn't mean that it is endemic through the entire county. I think the county is yearning for some more respect in politics. Yeah, I mean, yes, there are people on the right and the left who love the shrill nature of the action and the shouting, but there are a lot of people who just want, if not centrist policies, at least a common sense person to listen to both sides, go with whatever his or her conscience says, but be willing to listen and open and think of Democrats as friends, as Republicans as friends, who differ on an issue without really being angry at one another. We need to have more civility in politics. And I think I've always represented that. And that's what, with my history as being a judge, a probate judge, a circuit judge, and a prosecutor who was always looking for fundamental fairness. People understand that that's basically my personality, that I'm going to think carefully about things, give the other side its due, come up with whatever I think is the principal decision. I'm not here to attack Republicans. In fact, Senator Simpson from Wyoming talked about how with Trump taking over the party, the Republican Party is just no longer what it was. I want to work with the Republicans who want to work with us, and that's a lot of them. That's clearly the vast majority, and we have to let the voices at the fringes just kind of like calm down, and let's get to the business of governing. Now, this is what I think, feel in my gut, and I guess the bottom line, the objective answer is that the polling tells me that the polling wouldn't show me in the lead if I weren't in the lead. I know some people will argue about that. The polls are, manufactured and crooked and all that. But they can say what they want. I've been in this business long enough to know that polls in general reflect the mood of the people. And the mood of the people show that this is an evenly balanced district. I mean, even my 4% lead, let's face it, that's within the margin of error. So I'm not saying I'm winning by 4%. Would be nonsense. All I'm saying is that this is an evenly divided race in which a debate between the candidates is going to be huge, and let the chips fall where they may.
All right. Well, we're going to have to get going here. One more question, though, if I could, before we take off. How do you think Pete Lucido is doing as prosecutor in Macomb County?
Pete's put his foot into it so often now. I've always enjoyed the guy as a personal friend, but I've got some big problems in the way that he's been doing the job. That's just the fact.
Thank you very much, Carl Marlinga. He is running as a Democrat in the 10th Congressional District, former probate judge and prosecutor. Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you. Okay.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Appreciate Jamie Swofford for joining us a little earlier, and also Carl Marlinga, and also Andrew Miniger, the boss John Rink, and Samantha Schreiber. Samantha, great job last week picking up. I almost didn't want to do it again this week. I thought, you know, Samantha did such a good job. Maybe I should just let her do it.
It was definitely, you make it look a lot easier than what it actually is. It was stressful because I couldn't figure out your soundboard, which is probably my fault for not paying better attention when I am in the studio with you, Kyle.
Well, I can't figure it out either, so.
But it was awesome, though. I mean, I'm definitely very thankful for all of the guests. And, you know, obviously last week was just a very interesting week. And I'm excited to see what this week brings to the table, too, especially as we get closer to the primary season. And I am going to be doing some coverage of some different primary races. So stay tuned.
Post-production of MERS Monday is by Mark Bayshore Audio of Okemos. Thanks to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. And until next week, I'm Kyle Mullen. Take care.